Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, September 23rd, 1995. In the Creekside room this morning, our speaker is Jack Sage. His subject, Washington History, Part 5. Let's join this already in progress.
The churches in the Palouse were changed quite a bit when they had these Germans coming in. The German Congregational Church was started in Endicott about 1883, and La Crosse 1895, and Colfax in 1897. They're all little communities right close. The German Lutheran Church was started in Endicott in 1890, and Farmington, which is called Christ Lutheran, in 1896, and then Colfax Peace Lutheran about 1902. We had Germans competing against each other with different denominational interests. World War I in 1914 and 1917 curtailed emigration to the United States, and of course the Russian Revolution in 1917 stopped further emigration to the United States altogether. So it was quite a few years before they let Russians come. Other German-Russian colonies were located in Adams and Lincoln County, which are a little further north of Palouse. Primarily Lynn, where Don and I lived for a while, Odessa and Ritzville. And these are all German and Russian communities. I mean, in fact, a lot of the churches used to have German services in their native language. Germans in various other ways came as refugees after World War II, as post-war brides and as in-laws to American GIs. We have a lot of them in our community because we're close to military bases. And we have a McCord Air Force Base, we have a Fort Lewis Army Base right close. And so a lot of them are from there. Our court has, I think we have seven homes, and we have about three Germans in there. Mm-hmm. And our brides, and they are very good. They have this, they show the rest of us up with their yards. We're kind of upset with them sometimes. Can't keep up with them. The Hutterites, they're an interesting group. And we lived in eastern Washington for a while, close to one of the communities, one of the colonies that they're called. And they traced their roots to the 16th century Protestant Reformation, and they came from the areas primarily of Switzerland, Germany, and the Ukraine of Russia. They believe in simple communal living, although they use the most modern farm machinery. And that was something, they had little cabins and stuff to live in, but they had the most modern farm machinery. Nobody owns their own automobiles, but they do have station wagons to go shopping and so forth with, but they don't have any private ones. The women and the girls wear dark dresses and cover their heads with scarves. How'd you like that? It doesn't change it, does it? No. Men are clean-shaven until marriage. They don't seek converts, but sometimes a convert will join a colony. Sometimes the kids, you know, they want out of there when they're teenagers, especially if they go to the public schools, like some of them have to until they get enough money to pay for their own teacher. And they have to get a certified teacher to teach in the state of Washington. At age 15, their lessons in the community school end, if they've got a school on their farm. They have all the kids. Women take care of the kids. They don't have babysitters, but they take care of all the kids, no matter whose they are. Mm-hmm. The little ones are too small to go to school. And then they work in the fields. Have a lot of them work in the fields with the men and so forth. The men, between the ages of 18 and 24, they can make a decision if they want to become baptized. They don't force them to any earlier or anything else. The final or next step is after that is marriage. And they rarely marry within their own local colony because of close relationships. For several hundred years, they've been intermarrying. And so they don't marry first cousins as a rule. But they may marry distant cousins, which is quite often. They don't allow television sets in their colonies, but sometimes radios that play only gospel music are allowed. That's all I can hear is gospel music. Some of the children after the ninth grade may take high school correspondence courses, but most of them don't go to high schools because they're ridiculed because of the clothes they have to wear and so forth. And so it's kind of tough on them. So most of them after the ninth grade, they won't continue their education. Most of their parents don't believe an extensive academic education is important, since they only need a practical education to run a farm, and that's all. There are four colonies in the state, and all of them in eastern Washington, and they're all right close to the Columbia Basin area. Some of them have been able to raise wheat with irrigation as high as 200 bushels to an acre. And the average in the United States is between 35 and 50 at the most.
Wow.
And so they, by intensive farming techniques, have been able to do that.
Do they use a lot of pesticides and herbicides?
Yeah, they use a lot of fertilizer. It's liquid type, okay. And they run it through the fields. Ordinarily in the state of Washington, the dry land, most of the wheat farms are every other year you farm on it, and then you have summer fallow on it. But where they have the irrigation and so forth, and by putting a lot of fertilizer, and they can get a crop every year. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of water, and it takes a lot of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. But the soil it's a lava soil. It's very rich when you get your fertilizer and water to it. And that's one of the things about the Columbia Basin Project they built the Cooley Dam in the 1930s. That was one of President Roosevelt's works projects. And they built it to not only for power and irrigation, but also to give people work. Mm-hmm. And so many of them worked on the dams. Cooley Dam was one of the first ones after Bonneville. Okay. Now, early Chinese immigrants, got to tell you about those. The railroads were built from back east, and they didn't have many laborers. And so they imported Chinese laborers from China to build from about Minnesota to probably just past Spokane. And then after the railroad was completed, there were no jobs for them. And so a lot of them went out, and they'd follow the miners who had been up in the gold fields. They'd follow the mines, and they were like gleaners. They'd go and follow behind them, and they were so patient they could find flakes of gold and so forth where the earlier miners hadn't bothered with. And so a lot of them did that. However, some of them settled in Tacoma. And this is in the 1880s, Tacoma was home to more than 200 Chinese, many of whom had worked on the West Coast railroads. When the jobs became scarce, city residents of Tacoma blamed the Chinese immigrants. And then on November 3rd, 1885, Tacoma residents, with the blessing of the mayor and other civic leaders, went door to door and forced every Chinese man, woman, and child to leave town. And they had to leave almost immediately. They put them on trains and away they went. Although many other cities tried to follow Tacoma's example, Tacoma remains the only large West Coast city without a large Chinese American population. Now, Seattle has a Chinese American, and Portland has one. Of course, San Francisco, and a lot, most of the West Coast ones have them, except Tacoma. And they were a bunch of prejudicial people at that time. They were very, very cruel about the way they did it. Now, I'll talk briefly about the black. We have the black history. The earliest black in the Northwest is Marcus Lopez, who had accompanied Captain Gray on his voyages in 1792. Now, Captain Gray was American, and he discovered the mouth of the Columbia River, and he sailed up it with his sailing vessel, which was named the Columbia. And that's how come the Columbia River is named Columbia. He was the only one that when they sailed up and down the Washington and Oregon coast, especially in the wintertime, it's really stormy. They call the mouth of Columbia River the graveyard of ships, because it's over between 300 and 400 ships have been sunk off the mouth. So when they came by, they sailed by, they didn't realize that there was a river in there. They sailed 50 miles or so off the, even though silt and so forth flowed way out into the ocean, they didn't figure that that was coming from a river, which it did. The Columbia River at that time drained a huge area of the Northwest. But this early, Marcus Lopez, he was probably cabin boy for Captain Gray, the U.S. Captain Gray was a U.S. Navy man, actually. The Washington Territory early settlers included George Bush, the real George Bush, He was a black, and he founded the New Market, which is later called Tumwater, and that's close to Olympia, our state capital. Okay. And it's, in fact, his farm area, some of it is still there. So. His son, William Owen Bush, George's son, was elected to the state legislature in 1889. George Washington, another real George Washington, was another black. He arrived in the Washington Territory in 1852, and he founded a town called Centralia. We call it Centralia because it's halfway between the Columbia River at Longview and Tacoma. And they called it Centerville for many years, and then the railroad changed it over because that was a railroad terminal. They changed it over to Centralia, which is what it's called today. Early Tacoma residents were, some of them came in 1889. We didn't have too many before we had statehood. We had a woman by the name of Nettie Asbury. She came as a music teacher about that time. We had an attorney. He came, Lawrence Sledge. He was a black attorney in 1909. He came in 1890, and I don't know where he got his law degree unless it was the University of Washington. But he was a lawyer in Tacoma. Hezekiah Rice arrived in 1889, and he had been a miner in Roslyn in 1888. And Roslyn is where North, if you watched our, what do they call it, Northwest?
Northern Exposure
is filmed there. It's the Northern Pacific Railroad. When they first ran the railroad over the mountains, they discovered coal up there. And the Cascades are just have a lot of coal veins in it. And so Roslyn was one of the first one. They had a lot of the whites came there, and then they wanted to get better wages and better conditions. So they went on strike. And so the railroad's owners imported blacks to as strike breakers. And so a lot of them moved into the Roslyn area. And this Hezekiah Rice was one of the first ones. We had some... A couple, J.H. and Ella Ryan, arrived in 1900 in Tacoma, and then they published a newspaper for the blacks. William Arthur Dixon arrived in 1904 and managed the Olympus Hotel dining room, which is one of the better hotels in Tacoma was at that time. One fellow arrived in 1892 and ran a barbershop. A lot of the barbershops were run by blacks in those days. I don't know, some of them, I didn't know if they trusted razors or not, because that's the way they shaved you, you know. We in Steilacoom, our first black we had was a barber also. And he came in 1875, which is very early for blacks to come and settle in the Northwest. We had one by the name of a black named Horace Prince Lawhorn. He arrived in 1899 and was a Tacoma police officer, the first black Tacoma police officer. In 1899. We had another fellow came in 1920, Hollowell, and he was the proprietor of an auto laundry and an author. That was quite a combination. Instead of being a car wash, they called it an auto laundry at that time. And that was in the 1920s. We had another one, Blanche L. Gaston. She was a nurse, and her home in 1912 was occupied by five generations of her family at one time. It's up in the Hilltop area. It's right close to where the Tacoma News Tribune has their newspaper headquarters and printing plant and so forth. But she had five generations of her family at one time. And the house is still standing, in spite of it. Seattle had a black history, too. Most of their early settlers were sailors from ships docking in the ports in the Puget Sound. Then they went up to Seattle. Many blacks came as servants. Many had been railroaders in the eastern United States, and many in the 1860s came from areas of the Northwest first or Western Canada. Canada was very lenient on blacks and in fact, others. So you could come into Canada and then come back down. A lot of our immigrants, in fact, that's where most of the Canadians that live in the United States came, was they came west and then down across the border. We have no fences on our border or anything else, and we just have stations for checking here. What are you bringing into the states? Many had left Oregon because of the territory's harsh anti-Negro laws. They had been forbidden residence and property ownership in Oregon from 1844 until following the Civil War. So when they came on the wagon trains, they could come into Oregon, but they couldn't own property, couldn't vote, they couldn't do anything else. They had no citizenship, even though they were free men. Most of them were free, and they weren't slaves. They would allow slaves in there, but they wouldn't allow them to have any rights at all. So they'd come up to Washington. And some also came from the gold fields of California. In 1849, it was a gold rush into California, and they got there, and they were eased out, so they came up north. And also, Seattle's increase of black population occurred only after the completion of the railroads. And the last one was in 1909 with the Milwaukee Railroad. Now, blacks settled in the what we call the Franklin-Newcastle area instead of Seattle. Now, Seattle has coal also in the surrounding area, Renton and so forth. They have mines, and most of them they haven't used for quite a few years. And so they've sealed most of them. But the blacks came, and they wouldn't let them live in Seattle. They wouldn't let them in other towns. So they built a special town called Franklin, named after Ben Franklin. And it was close to what we have, the Green River. We have Green River Park, beautiful park, Geyser Park. And it was on the hill, and so that's where all the blacks lived. And all is left there, some foundations and a few things now. After the coal mines, coal ceased being important, why they closed it down. The repression of blacks in the Deep South after the Civil War also drove many of them to the North and the West, even though they were supposed to have rights after the war that Union Army promised them when they enlisted and so forth, but they didn't follow through. The Northern Pacific Railroad, the Great Northern Railroad, and the Canadian Pacific Railroad encouraged the migration with special immigration rates on their system. And in 1888 and 1889, this is when the black miners came to Roslyn to work in the coal mines of the Northern Pacific Railway. 2 years later, about 600 black strikebreakers were imported by the Oregon Improvement Company mines of King County. Most settled in places like this early Franklin I was telling you about, instead of Seattle until much later. Now, if you didn't get a chance to go to Roslyn, did you?
No.
It's an interesting town. If you had the time, they have a cemetery that has 26 different cemeteries. It's because they didn't want to be buried next to Yugoslavians, didn't be buried next to British. And there's even one cemetery with two Druids in it. But there's a Negro cemetery, as it's called, for the blacks. There's over 200 buried there that were killed in the mine accidents and so forth. And there's only about 6 monuments in the whole area. And so what they're going to try to do is find out who's buried where. And I don't know how they'll do it because there's not really any markers. Mm-hmm. I've been up there to take pictures of it because they have a historical group who's trying to preserve it. And they got the areas all marked off and everything. You can go and walk through it. You can see depressions where the graves were, but there's no markers. Hopefully somebody kept a record of some of the families. There's a family by the name of William Craven, who were the early settlers there, and I met them about 3 years ago at a basketball tournament in Tacoma Dome. I have them sitting up there, and I was watching a girls' basketball team from Clay Ellen, and the girls from Roslyn go to school at Clay Ellen. And I was sitting with the fans, and one of them was a black fellow, and told his name, and I says, "Oh yeah, I know all about it. I've been up there," and so he was, I think he was the son of the mayor, and anyway, he told me about the organization that's working to restore this cemetery and rehabilitate it and see if they can get all the names. Seattle and Tacoma competed for these new residents to their communities. The non-whites were not always welcome. However, when they came to the cities to spend their wages from working in the hop fields or mines, they were reluctantly accepted, at least until their money ran out in the towns. They were good that way. We used to run special trains down to, when I worked for the North Pacific, special trains from the mines and also from Clay Ellum. They'd go to, usually at the end of the month, so everybody could spend their money, and then go back broke, most of them are a little bit under the weather from little alcohol problems. The early black men's work in Seattle was very similar to Tacoma. They did common and menial labor. There were porters and janitors, coachmen, valets, painters, and peddlers. They also worked in lumber mills. We had a lot of lumber mills in Seattle. Yesler Mill was one. You've heard of the Skid Road or Skid Row. It was actually what it was where you skid the logs down the hill to the mills from the hills. And of course, as soon as they did that, then all the little prostitutes had their little cabins and stuff right by it. And so that's why an area is run down that's a Skid Row, you know. Some of them ran businesses like barbershops like they did in Tacoma. Another one was a barber and a restaurant owner in 1852 in Seattle, which is very early. And his name was Manuel Lopes. And William Gross was a restaurant cook and a rancher in 1860, also in Seattle. And then they had a lawyer competing with ours in Tacoma. John Edwards Hawkins was a lawyer in 1895. And then Horace Caton, and the Caton family were well known in the Northwest. They published what they called the Republican in 1894. And they named it Republican because Abraham Lincoln was their hero. And so they named their newspaper, and it was published for many years. And Susie Caton, his wife, was the journalist. She did most of the writing and very, very good at it. We had some little towns where the blacks lived. Ravensdale, it's just still there. It's right close to Franklin. Black Diamond. Ravensdale was named after, they used to have flocks of ravens. Did you go to this bird woman's talk?
Yeah.
She was talking about the ravens, how you could identify them. They're different than the crows. They have a kind of a wedge-shaped tail on them. They're big, bigger than a crow. In eastern Washington, we called the ravens black eagles because they were big. And so the natives all called those things black eagles. Anyway, they called it Ravensdale after a bunch of ravens would gather under the boxcars that had wheat in it, and the wheat would drain out, and so they got on the railroad tracks and they'd eat it. So they named the whole town Ravensdale. And this was about 1900, I imagine. Before that, the town was called Leary, but they didn't like Leary. They were leery of the name Leary, evidently, so they named it Ravensdale. And Black Diamond has derived its name from Black Diamond Coal Company of California, which opened mines in the area in the early 1880s. Those towns are small, but they're still there, the Ravensdale and Black Diamond. And Ravensdale was the railroad town, and Black Diamond is a little bit further away. And we have a lot of commuters who live in those small towns because they don't have to pay higher taxes and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I will finish here briefly with one of my favorites, the real George Washington, the story of him. He was born on August 15th, 1817, in Frederick County, Virginia, near Winchester. His father was part Negro and a slave. His mother was a white Englishwoman. Mr. and Mrs. Cochran, who agreed to take the child shortly after he was born, after George Washington was born, they were to take care of him until he became 21 years of age. When George was 4 years of age, this family, the Cochran family, moved to Ohio with him. When he was 9 years of age, they again moved, this time to Missouri. When he was fully grown, he was 6 foot tall and weighed nearly 200 pounds. March 15th, 1850, they left on a wagon train on the Oregon Trail to Oregon. They reached Oregon City after 117 days. He, that's George Washington, settled as a squatter in 1852 near the junction of the Skookumchuck River and the Chehalis River. Now these two rivers are in western Washington and the southwestern part. Grays Harbor is fed by the Chehalis River, and that's our upper harbor. And where the two met is where they settled. Skookumchuck means fast, rapid. And so it was a fast and strong river. Although it's not that fast now, they have a dam on it. So it slowed it down quite a bit. The Cochrans filed on 640 acres so that he wouldn't lose the land. See, now he was working the land, but he didn't have title to it yet in the state of Washington, or Washington Territory. They deeded the land to George after four years for $3,200 cash. He had cash. George knew how to make money and save money. And so he had the cash and he bought the 640 acres. In 1859, Jane Cochran died, and so Mrs. Cochran lived until 1861. George acquired 63 more acres in early 1860, and then he married Mary Jane Kunis in 1869 and bought her the first sewing machine in the area the following year. So that was 1870 when they had the first sewing machine in the Washington Territory. In 1872, the Northern Pacific Railroad crossed his land on its destination to Tacoma from Kalama. And since his land was halfway between the two towns, it was called Centerville. And later it became Centralia, and I was telling you about that one. And it he laid out the, it says here he had the first plat was filed in 1875. He laid them out in the squares, and he named them after gold, pearl, all kinds of gems, wealth, wealthy gems, because to him that was his wealth. Town. He sold lots for $10 a piece. He was a Baptist, and he donated two lots for a church site, and he also helped build that church. He donated 2 acres for a cemetery on his farm. He donated 1 block of the second edition of Centerville for a park. So he was very generous with his money. He was probably one of the first millionaires that we had in the state of Washington. And he knew how to get money, but he was generous with it also. His wife died in 1889, and he remarried the following year. He had a son called George Cleveland Washington. He got a couple presidents in there. On August 26, 1905, George died at 87 years of age. He left us a good heritage for the blacks and also for caring and compassion. Okay, I think I'll quit right there and if you have some questions or anything else.
We went through a town named George. Was that named after the president or after this George?
After the president.
Okay.
In fact, there's quite a story about that George. There's Martha Inn is there too.
Oh.
An inn. But the founder of it wanted to start a town there, and so he used the name George, and which is well known. But he owns some stores, a drugstore, and so forth. And one of the women customers came out of the store and fell. And filed a lawsuit against him, and so he didn't have any money other than the town. So the town turned over to this woman. So she owns it now. I don't. That's quite a story. But that's Spokane had quite a history. Spokane is they don't really care much for blacks, and they don't have many there. But they did have some early ones, and. One of them was, that's not the black. Here's the one, Spokane. They had one as a printer who was listed in the 1860 census, a black printer in Spokane. He made the maps for the military road. They had the Mullen Road and also other roads were made by the Army. And so they had to have maps. And I didn't bring some of them here. I have copies of some of the maps that they made. But then they had to print them for publications, and so evidently this Thomas D. Toza, who was born in Jamaica, was a map maker printer. Let's see here, there was only 6 blacks in 1880 in the Spokane Valley. Oh, that's all that were there. A carpenter, 2 farmers, and 3 farm laborers. But during the 1880s, Spokane was incorporated, and the Northern Pacific came through. And by 1900, there were 376 black residents, not counting 102 black servicemen stationed at Fort George Wright. Many of the arrivals in the 1880s were former slaves. One of them was a woman who was a granddaughter of a Spanish sea captain who left his pregnant wife in the care of a tavern keeper in Savannah, Georgia. And she finally ended up out here. Let's see here. We had they had another one who had enlisted in the Union Army in 1962 and served in the cavalry. And after the South surrendered, worked his way west, which a lot of the blacks did. Very few of them settled in Spokane because they weren't like some areas weren't allowed to own property, mm-hmm. weren't allowed to vote, and so forth. However, recent years, one of the mayors was a black, William Chase. I knew him. I met him because that wasn't too many years ago, about 10, 15 years ago. They have very few. In fact, I'll tell you who the black mayors were or have been. Willie Craven, who I was telling you about in Roslyn, he was from 1975 to 1979. And then this Jim Chase in Spokane was from 82 to 85. Joe Jackson in Pasco from 83 to 87. I didn't know Joe, but I've met Henry Beecham, our Beauchamp, as they spell it here, of Yakima from 1986 to 1988. I met him. And Norm Rice of Seattle, still from 1989 to the present, is still mayor, a very good mayor. And Harold Moss of Tacoma, 1994 to the present. And he's up for election this fall. Okay.
Are you from out of state or Colorado?
Colorado Springs. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that, yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of Air Force people who were at Colorado Springs at one time.
You have a
huge
base there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of your teachers have been great at helping us understand Washington. We knew very little or nothing about the state. Especially in terms of history.
A lot of our people that live here don't either, you know. Because a lot of them, we have about 4.5 million people in the state now. And I think when I was born, there was only about, it was less than a man, probably. And so that's a lot of changes.
Well, believe it or not, the people in Colorado who tend to come to Washington, Oregon.
Is that right?
Because they're tired of desert and they want rain.
You've had a long drought. And that's how we got a lot of them in the 1930s here. See, they had the Dust Bowl in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and it was really tragic. I can remember the people coming, and they'd come in old cars. And they get to a little town of Sprague where I lived, near Spokane. Mm-hmm. And they'd look up my dad because he had Red Cross coupons. And so they get enough gas to get to Richfield, the next town. And so they'd get some sandwiches, you know, they'd get sandwiches from the restaurant. And they kept moving them on. And I can remember some of the kids in school would come and they'd stay in a vacant house, you know, for a while and go to school and then move on, you know. Mm-hmm. I've often wondered what happened to some of those kids, you know. Because it was real tough times. And thankfully, we had what they called the WPA. So some of these people had a chance to work and get a little bit of...
Right.
And of course, they built a lot of stuff for the... Like Grand Coulee Dam was one of them that built. Boulder Dam was another one built with those projects. And
Oregon Highway 101.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, much
of... I'm
reading
about that,
mm-hmm. too. Yeah, much of the public... improvements were done then, and they had no other money. We had the three C's, the Civilian Conservation Corps. If you've been hiking in some of these shelters and stuff, you'll find some shelters that were made back in the 30s that are still standing up around Mount Rainier, quite a few. Some in Glacier Park, Montana.
Mm-hmm. Being so close to the Santa Fe Trail, we hear a lot of that history, but rarely do we hear anything about the Oregon Trail. So
yeah, the Oregon Trail is, there was over 300,000 people traveled on that.
It's a long way.
Yeah, and it took them 6 months. And I was just copying it. I found a book in the library in here about the women's diaries, what it was like and what the women had to go through. Mm-hmm. And all they had to do was, you know, cook, take care of the children, wash clothes, and pick up buffalo chips to burn. And then when there wasn't enough buffalo chips, they walked behind the wagons and gathered weeds to burn for that night.
Wow.
You know, it was pretty rough. A lot of children were born on the trail, you know, in 6 months' time, you know. Like my great-great... grandmother, she left with a 3-month-old daughter. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what like 6 months. Well, of course, it was 9 months by the time they got. Mm-hmm. But no disposable diapers or anything.
Yeah.
It was something. Well, anyway,
Thank you.
I enjoyed doing it myself. Mm-hmm. I like the research as much as anything.
I can tell you have fun with it.
Oh, I have it. I really enjoy it. I got a lot of it written out. I put most of it on my word processor, on my my data disk. Someday I'm going to get it all together, and if she doesn't burn it first.
Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here.
Yes,
and enjoy
you.
Your trip through Washington.
Thanks.
And take all these little side trips. You see the historical markers. Stop and see them.